from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Early in the current President Bush's political career, staffers went out of their way to remind reporters that the current commander-in-chief is W, not HW. 43, not 41. A governor who propelled himself into the White House, not a vice president who eased into the presidency. But the similarities, the links are fundamental. Same first name, same last name, same high school, same college, same fraternity, same love of baseball, same work in West Texas oil, same blood. And now, perhaps, same war. Iraq is unfinished business for the Bush family. More than a decade ago, Bush the father liberated Kuwait but left Saddam Hussein standing. Now Bush the son is zeroing in on Baghdad, training the crosshairs of the U.S. military on Saddam, the guy, he says in reference to a failed assassination plot, who tried to kill my dad. If the United States launches a new attack on Iraq, it will be seen inevitably as a father-son war. But what kind of father-son war is tough to say? Hamlet or Oedipus? Avenging a father's failure or stepping out of a father's shadow? What effect is the father-son dynamic between George W. and George H.W. having as a Bush White House once again wages war with Iraq? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us tonight from Austin, Texas, is Bill Minutaglio, author of First Son, George W. Bush and the Bush Family Dynasty. Welcome and good evening, Bill Minutaglio.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for being with us. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Bill Minutaglio, take us into this. When you look at George Sr. and George Jr., as you have done in great depth, do you see the current sitting president, the 43rd Bush president, living his life, exercising his authority as president, perhaps approaching the war in Iraq in imitation of his father, in a kind of extension of his father, in opposition to his father?
I'm going to be a politician and say yes to all three of the options.
We figured you might, but
I've probably been around him too long, and too many politicians would cause me to say that. But it's just unavoidable and impossible to ignore. I mean, George W. Bush, for his entire life, has walked in his father's shadow. It's an extremely competitive family, and I happen to believe that the best prism through which to view George W. Bush is his father. To really understand him, to understand his motivations, and yes, to understand his policies.
How so? In what respects?
Sure. I think in good measure, I could tell you this. There's a better way to start this by telling you that George W. resists this kind of conversation with his whole heart and soul. It's a complete anathema to him what we're embarking upon.
And
here.
So that's exactly where we'll go.
Well,
no disrespect intended,
but we're
picking up the rocks here and looking underneath to see what we've got. They
sure.
are father and son. That's only happened once before in American history.
Sure. He calls it, he resists it so much that, of course, it makes you wonder why would he resist this inquiry, the suggestion that his life and even, in fact, his public policies are influenced by his relationship with his father. So you have to go there, and I think it's a merit-worthy topic. I think, you see George W. Saying, as you had said earlier, this is a man, Saddam Hussein, who'd come after my dad. You see George W. Bush, or you hear about George W. Bush, en route back to Washington on the day of 9/11, returning to the nation's capital, and we hear reports that he's on the telephone calling his father, seeking advice, perhaps checking in with his dad to see how the family's doing. I'm hoping that occurred and presuming that occurred, but as well seeking advice from him on perhaps the most pivotal day that'll ever exist in his administration. So they're interwoven, they're intertwined, and he's constantly influenced by his dad.
But how do you see him then as he looks at such an enormous undertaking, one that would already probably is a defining element of his presidency, at least first term, if another term is to follow? How do you see him approaching that in light of his father? Do you expect, from what you know of these two men, that George W. Bush is saying to himself, Saddam Hussein, you messed with my dad. You fought with him. You didn't get out of Kuwait when he ordered you out. You sent assassins into Kuwait after the war to try and finish him off, to kill my dad, as he said, when he came back to the Middle East for his victory lap after the Gulf War. So is he looking for a kind of revenge? We're gonna complete this ring cycle? Or is he thinking, or maybe it's somewhere beyond thinking, my father wasn't able to finish this, but I will, and in so doing, trump my father?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, again, I'm going to sound like a politician. You're right on both counts. He desperately, he'll deny this till the cows come home in Texas. He desperately wants to crawl out, finally, once and for all, from his father's shadow. He's been measured against his dad for his entire life, as you indicated earlier. Same high school, same college, fraternity, secret society. He was a pilot, but not really as good and as honored a pilot as his father had been in the military.
His father flew 58 combat missions in World War II, was recently back in the Pacific, sitting in a dinghy in the middle of the Pacific, where he was finally shot down, reliving that day. George W. was in the Texas National Guard, or Air Wing thereof.
Exactly, flying basically over Texas and not in the theater of war, which was available at that time, as you know, the Vietnam War.
Do you see then a kind of, I realize there's all kinds of pop psychology flying here tonight, but we're just wading in because you've got to wade in somewhere. Do you see an inferiority complex sitting in there, waiting to be resolved perhaps through war?
His entire life, and again, he'll deny this and has denied it. He literally has said, I'm free, I'm not burdened by any level of expectations in my family. No one's ever, you know, acutely, specifically measured me against my father. But either he's not seeing it or not hearing it, or he's in some form of denial when he says that, because, of course, people are measuring him. It's unavoidable and inescapable. It's human nature, I think. But you also got to consider this is an extraordinarily competitive family. He is the first son. And though he might not have had the expectations outlined for him in the family, I maintain that they were there. Like invisible blinking signs at the side of the highway. He always knew that he would be following his father. He bears his father's name, and he'd have to live up to what his father had carved out. I maintain it really is almost something out of either Shakespeare or Greek tragedy, that he'll have to do a couple of things, either deliver Saddam Hussein, something his father had never done, to some end, and then as well probably get reelected as president, something his father had never done as well. He needs to do something, I think, ultimately, to really rest at peace with his own legacy at some point, that trumps his dad. And I think that, yes, does in part motivate him.
Jack Beatty, join us here. A nation that elects the son of a living father, an ex-president, buys quite a complicated psychological package.
Yeah, it sure does. Of course, my license to practice this stuff comes from Sears Roebuck.
duly noted.
duly noted. But, you know, what's striking, I've just been looking back through Frank Bruni's biography, Ambling into History of George W., and what comes through there is that just has got to be a lot of ambivalence from this son toward that father. The sense that comes through is that the father and the family was disappointed in him, and that he's never quite got the approval he needs, and that much of that has gone to his brother Jeb. He writes, George W. does, in his autobiography about Jeb, he was the brother who was supposed to win in November of 1994. Well, of course, W. won. His mother told W. she didn't think he should run. They didn't think, you know, that was going to be Jeb's year.
Jeb was the golden boy.
And then Bruni has this scene at Kennebunkport where they're talking, and suddenly Mr. Bush says, I'm amazed, still amazed at the way he's done. This is talking about his son. Then Jeb comes in, and his mother makes a point of saying how articulate Jeb is. His father keeps tossing the questions to Jeb. Jeb keeps answering. This goes on, and they keep talking about Bush winning because of the context. People were tired of Clinton. They had to switch parties, not saying anything about their son. And suddenly it dawns on Bruni, and he says quite remarkably, he says, these remarks suggest a limit to the faith, which is different from love, that George W. Bush's parents and siblings had in him. George W. must have sensed this, must have spent a lifetime sensing this. He must have noticed the kind of thing that I did when, in Kennebunkport, his father deferred to Jeb and then beamed with admiration as Jeb spoke so articulately and so authoritatively. How often, before 1994, before now, had George W. been on the receiving end of such an impressed expression. Think of that. A lifetime of that stuff going on. And you know, it's gonna fill you with all sorts of feelings toward your father. But one of them is going to be, Dad, you didn't quite approve of me. I've surprised you, as the father says. I'm amazed.
Bill Minutaglio, does that add up to you? There's Frank Bruni's take. We've read yours as well in First Son. Is there a chip on this presidential shoulder that a war might work off?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, at the outset of my book, I describe an anecdote in which George W. Bush came home one day, and this was in the middle of his young and irresponsible years, as he used to call them, which sounds like the name of a Frank Sinatra album. He came home in the early 70s one night, a little beery, a little bit out of it. In fact, he had been drinking and then had gone out driving with his younger brother Marvin, and they were knocking over garbage cans and heading back to his father's house, a townhouse in Washington, and came in and got into this rather amazing, I think any parent could really relate to this, came in and got into this amazing confrontation with his father. And George W. challenged his dad to a fight. You know, do you want to go mano a mano? And the father was essentially suggesting, look, you're wasting your life. You're the prodigal son that hasn't yet come back in.
And how old was George W. at this point?
He was 30 years old. So he was 30 years old.
Okay.
A fully grown, you know, guy who should have been maybe not out doing that, driving and maybe even putting his younger brother in some sense in some danger or other people in danger. He spent a lot of time, you know, wandering, and it's significant, I think, that most people who have studied Bush zone in on the age of 40 at a time period in his life when he began changing. And people talk about how he abruptly stopped drinking at the age of 40. What a lot of people have not chosen to examine is exactly why he stopped drinking. If you hear it from the Bush campaign and read some things, it suggests that George W. stopped drinking for health reasons, and he was getting himself disciplined finally. What a few very close friends of his told me was that, in fact, he stopped drinking in service to his father. When George W. turned 40, it was in 1986, and it was when his dad was really beginning, you know, his run for the White House, and George W. very quietly told folks, you know what, I'm very afraid that I'll embarrass my father, and I'll derail his chances to succeed and finally get what he wants at the White House. And, you know, when you weigh in that kind of a dynamic and the machinations and the thing that would drive him to finally clean up his act in a, you know, very important way and abandon this.
At that time, his father's ambitions. I mean, to his credit, though, George W. Bush makes no bones about having misspent a few years. He's pretty straightforward about that. But now he finds himself in the White House. We read of his father's former advisors. Of course, there are many of them around him, Dick Cheney and right on down the list, Condoleezza Rice even, Donald Rumsfeld. But others, Brent Scowcroft, pitching in advice from the sidelines that hasn't been fully in sync with the aggressive drive on Baghdad. Do you think George W. has an open ear to that kind of advice from his father's crustier old tier of advisors?
I think, if you're asking me, I believe that he relies enormously to a degree that we don't really know, in an informal way, which is the way George W. Bush likes to receive a lot of information, by the way, and kind of off-the-cuff conversations, meetings at Kennebunkport, kind of casual asides. He's not long, as we probably do know, not long in gigantic position papers delivered to him at the White House. He doesn't stay up till 4 in the morning reading those, but he relies on a lot of schmoozing, you might call it, and it even extends beyond the roster of folks you mentioned. To me, one of the true Svengali's or interesting characters in his life is Karl Rove, a guy who's enormously powerful and about which very little is known, but is really the man who's orchestrated George W.'s entire political rise.
And yet, Jack Beatty, at this late hour, we don't really know if George W. is being influenced toward or away from war by his father and his father's circle.
I think we can intuit that he's certainly being tutored to go through the UN to get allies, not to do this alone.
But he's still suggesting he won't do that.
Yes, but I can. But you know, when he's got Jim Baker writing that if you go through the UN and get their approval, this will be fine. That's like a memo from Dad, and I don't think we have to be in much doubt that that's how the father would go about it.
But whether the son will go the same way, who knows? We're talking tonight about the dynamics of a father-son war about two Bushes, Iraq and Saddam Hussein. Is this war personal for George W. Bush? You can join us tonight at 1-800-4-7-7-7. 423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the dynamics of a father-son war, about two Bushes, Iraq and Saddam Hussein. You can join the conversation tonight. Is this war personal for George W. Bush? Is it revenge for an attempt on his father's life? Is it compensation for his father's failure to vanquish Saddam Hussein? Is it an errant son's effort to trump his father's legacy? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight by Bill Minutaglio. He's author of First Son, George W. Bush and the Bush Family Dynasty. He's got a forthcoming book coming out, City on Fire. He's joining us tonight from Austin, Texas. And also in the studio tonight, I'm happy to be joined by Samuel Osherson. He's a practicing psychotherapist on the faculty of the Harvard Medical School. He's author of Finding Our Fathers, How a Man's Life is Shaped by His Relationship with His Father. Good evening and welcome, Samuel Osherson.
Pleasure, Tom.
Thanks so much for being with us. Here we've all been, Bill's been throwing in a lot of interesting information here, but then we're all flapping our jaws about father-son psychology. You're the professional. When you look at this twinning, or at any twinning like this, where a son steps into the job or role that a father once had, how does all the psychodrama of father-son relationship come into play?
Well, the father is such an important figure in any son's life. I think of the Bushes almost as being a family business, and the son has really come into the family business with a father who he is succeeding. And I think in situations like that, as in most situations, the father is really an audience for the son, and the son carries around a construction of the father. You know, we don't know our fathers very well. Most sons really don't have an accurate image of what their fathers really feel, because fathers and sons don't talk a lot.
We may know their resumes.
We know their resumes, and out of that, in a way, we build the kind of cartoon image of our father. And my hunch is, I don't know the Bushes, and we're speculating here tonight, but many sons carry around an image of their father that may not actually be an accurate representation of who their father actually is.
Now, when he sees his father, he has to know the bio: star at Yale, war hero, oil man, ambassador, head of the CIA, vice president, president. I mean, it's a big resume. George W. Bush is now president, but his father's resume probably still outshines his, at least to this point. So if it's whether it's the White House or a family business, and given this veil of unknowing that you described, that sons don't fully know their fathers, yet they do have an image of them that, as you're saying, the father's the audience, the son plays to. So what does that play? Is it Hamlet? Is it Oedipus? How does the play go?
Well, I mean, it varies. It's probably a combination of the two. I mean, most sons want to surpass their fathers and do better and show the old man, as George W. seemed to have wanted to when he was 30, that I can beat you. But on the other hand, you also want to redeem your father, and you want to make his life better and justify his life and justify the investment that he put into you. So most of us, I think, walk between those two poles, and the decisions we make come out of that. It's a complicated process, because even when you want to trump your dad, we were talking about George W. wanting to trump his father. But I think Jack was onto something when he talked about the ambivalence that the son feels, because in trumping your father, you're in very new territory, and that's scary territory.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many examples in history of generals whose fathers were also famous generals who hesitated at the moment when they might have won a decisive victory, in part, I think, because to win a victory when your father failed is also a very frightening thing.
Ooh. That is a fascinating thought. Hold that thought. Bill Minutaglio, what about that? We see then possibly in a new war with Iraq the possibility of the son both trumping and redeeming his father, the two desires that Samuel Osherson, the psychotherapist, points out is almost universal.
I can see that that's probably a valid point. Again, I'd mention that I don't know that George W., again, is walking around with him. You know, a skull in his hand. I don't think we see him doing that at the White House, thinking in these terms. But again, I would maintain that it probably is unavoidable in some way for him to confront this. And I think he's really wrestled his entire life with both how to capitalize on his father's legacy and yet distance himself from it, and especially in terms of politics. How do I grow, learn, and yes, use my father's political network, capitalize on it in a very coldly pragmatic way,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, use that toward my end, but at the same time distance myself from it so that it appears that I am independent. And this surfaced quite often, I think, in the presidential campaign, especially when the Bush campaign rolled into New Hampshire and got walloped by, in a surprise for them, by John McCain in the primary in the winter of 2000.
And this after Father Bush had come to New Hampshire and put his big paternal arm around the son.
And referred to him as my boy.
Mm-hmm.
The Bush inner network reconnoitered, gathered, and said, you know what, George W., you need to have your father go away.
That'll be enough of that boy stuff.
You need to have your father, in essence, though you love him, and though you perhaps in some way need to continue to ride his coattails a little further, he needs to go away. And, you know, what an awful decision, perhaps, for anybody. The stakes are very high. Divorced from how you feel about George W. Bush politically, here you are confronting an awful decision. I love mm-hmm. my father. I'm a member of the family. And yet I need to have him disappear, in essence. I'd like to just add something real quickly that was just mentioned that's very germane. When George W. was growing up, his father really was an absentee father. His father was hustling very, very hard to make the family fortune, to make millions of dollars in the oil patch in West Texas, and consequently wasn't around. It was Barbara Bush who was... had probably a greater daily imprint on the son than the father. She was the one who showed up at the Little League baseball games.
Mm-hmm.
She was one of the original soccer moms, if you will. I mean, she was on site. The dad was crisscrossing the globe, making a lot of money in the oil patch, and he didn't really know his dad. His dad existed as a kind of a constantly moving, welling, growing legacy out there, and occasionally his dad would come in. George W., one time, I thought, very famously and very telling, and poignantly for him, because he's not prone to self-confession, he said, you know, my father and I never had the talk. And he said it almost wistfully and sadly. And he meant that his dad and he had never sat down and had that kind of semi-awkward discussion that a lot of dads might have with their teenage sons about the facts of life. And he said, I never had that moment with my dad, and it almost sounded as if he regretted
it. He had to get it elsewhere. Bill Minutugli, you raised so many interesting things. Let's rewind that tape just a little, Samuel Osherson. Bill points out that George W., and we all kind of know this intuitively, is no Hamlet with skull in hand. We don't picture him sitting in a leotard in the Lincoln bedroom anguishing over these things. But does that mean that he's any less susceptible to the father-son psychological dynamic than anyone else, as bluff and gruff as his public persona may be?
Yeah, no, I don't think the White House gives him a pass go for the basic father-son stuff. I think Bill's point about his comment that we never had the talk really humanizes George W., because how many men actually go around thinking that most men have had this talk with their dad? The talk in which life secrets are somehow communicated to them in a way that gives them some vitality and sturdiness. The truth of the matter is that many of us never had that talk with Dad. And we go around, Mark Twain once said that at the age of 12, a boy starts imitating a man and just keeps on doing that the rest of his life. And I think that there's some truth to that,
And what about the mother influence here?
Yeah.
Barbara Bush being, in fact, the bigger day-to-day influence in George W.'s life than George H.W. ever was.
Yeah, well, moms are very important. Moms communicate a version of dads to their children, as well as a version of women to their children. So whatever version Barbara communicated to George may be a large part of the image that the son carries around of the father.
And now, Jack Beatty, here sits the president, 50-something, and he's facing that challenge. Samuel Osherson refers to sons of generals who are sons of generals who may quail at that moment because it's just all too much. On the other hand, a great column by Ellen Goodman today where she says George W. may be looking for that great mission that's the equivalent of his father's World War II Greatest Generation kind of 58 combat missions moment. We're back to the trumping and redeeming.
Yeah, and here is his Bush 41 on that very subject. I'm quoting from Richard Ben Kramer's book, What It Takes. He's having a discussion with Roger Ailes at Kennebunkport. They're talking about World War II, about the bombing run over Chichi Jima Bush recounted how he saw flames shoot along the wing of his plane, smoke fill his cockpit. "Why didn't you bail out?" Ailes asked. Bush didn't pause, didn't think, didn't blink. "I hadn't completed my mission." And here's the son saying about his new war, "We now have our mission." So they're even using the same word. What's eerie here to me is, and Maureen Dowd has used this, who got her license at Sears Roebuck too, has used this word, is the obsessive element in this. And that's, I think, what for citizens we have to wonder about. Is this war, in some of its motivations, personal? That is it driven by factors that really are not things that should matter, that don't constitute reasons that most Americans think are worth shedding lives over?
But, Jack, you know what George W. would say in answer to that, or if he didn't speak himself, he'd throw up Cheney or Donald Rumsfeld, and they would go right down the security reasons that have impressed the world, that George Bush himself drew out in front of the entire United Nations. It didn't sound like a mewling session about where was my father when he stood in front of the UN. It was a list of security particulars, a threat to the world.
Go ahead, excuse me.
Well, it's interesting, actually, as you're talking, Jack, I'm thinking in some ways maybe there's a father-son generational dynamic in the country as a whole, which is that maybe George W. expresses the yearning that we all have to return to these World War II fathers, actually, who had a sense of mission and clarity. I mean, if Clinton was one of the first of the non-World War II presidents, and now we have George W. succeeding him, maybe this whole dynamic between this father and son expresses something in the country as a whole around fathers and sons that is captured in Dan Rather's book, The Greatest Generation, this kind of idealization of these World War II dads and a desire to return to that kind of world, which no longer, in fact, exists.
Mm-hmm. Bill Minutaglio, do you see, can you imagine George W. as wanting to establish that kind of super scale mission accomplished that would seem to add up to his father's? And can you imagine him being so swept away by that that it somehow, whether articulated or not, superseded the real security interests? Or is he more nuts and bolts than that?
George W., in some ways, almost skipped a generation, I think, in American history. He sees things in black and white and almost vaulted over the 60s. He's a very black and white guy. He resists ambiguity. I think, he loathes it in some way. And you could examine his public policies today and even the fact that he seems to be attempting to roll back a lot of public policies that had their true roots in the 60s. He grew up in the 60s. Maureen Dowd, to bring her name up again, has referred to the Bushes as the WASP Corleones. They are just this very intense, almost cloistered, old money, family. But
very successful businessmen for many generations. Grandfather a senator, father president.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely, and you can go back further generations, even into the 1800s. But
and we know that George Bush, I may have read this in your book, Bill, when he was Texas governor, he sat at the desk of Prescott Bush.
He's entirely surrounded by all the bits of history and the totems from previous generations. They're just all around him, just over his shoulder, yes, in the governor's mansion in Texas were photographs of his dad in heroic poses. And he's always been confronted. It's an interesting thing. He's always been confronted with images of his family. I remember talking to someone who had gone to school with him at Yale who told me that George W. had stepped on campus and saw, relatively soon after setting foot on campus, a giant photograph of his father posing with Babe Ruth, the ultimate
wow.
American sports icon.
Zeus.
George W. just sat there, with his hat in his head, just staring at this thing. And,
what am I going to do?
You could read the thought bubble over his head. How can I be the measure of this man? Will I ever stand next to Babe Ruth, of all people? And so it's... really, almost from birth again. I think we're on to something here that he's had to confront his father, even if his father wasn't exactly in the room with him. It's always been something he's had to deal with.
And yet he's also dealing with the real world. A lot of callers want to join us. Let's turn to them. Caroline's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Caroline. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, I had actually more of a comment than more of a question.
Share it.
I understand how there is the feeling that the whole father-son dynamic is pushing Bush more towards war and wanting to, in a sense, complete what his father did not complete. And I can understand how he's trying to have retribution for the attempt on his father's life, mm-hmm. on his father's life. Mm-hmm. But I'm kind of thinking that the more he got involved in discussing the dynamics of the security aspect and the potential threat to our country, I'm hoping that that kind of took more of a sideline and that kind of became more of a background versus caring for the actual country. And then my other comment was I'm not sure how trying to – goodness, what am I trying to say here? Trying to gain the approval of his father in a way – You mentioned something about Babe Ruth, and although he'll never be able to be standing in a photograph with Babe Ruth, there's always going to be someone in the next generation that will, in a way, equal Babe Ruth.
Well, that's right, and he co-owned his own baseball team, or managed anyway, in Texas.
Exactly. So I think, in a way, as much as he's trying to gain approval and possibly even trump his father, there are his own series of events and series of steps that he has to go through, which is a totally different role. And
His own path. Caroline, we've got it. Let me put it to Samuel Osherson. Again, you're the psychotherapist. How much can be pulled apart here? Let's say, on the one hand, George W. Bush, President of the United States, is getting briefings from his people. They're saying, here's a threat, here are the dimensions of the threat, here's what we need to do to nip it in the bud. That's very kind of, one level, dry and practical. But can anyone, even the chief executive of the country, see those facts apart from a father-son legacy relationship?
Well, you're talking to a psychologist here, and my take on human life is that we all see things in front of us in terms of our own, in part, our own ways of seeing, our own conflicts, our own identifications with other people. I would assume that Bush, when he's sitting there looking at a range of options, is presented with a range of options, and what he might do will vary, but that given who he is, certain dynamics and conflicts might move him to pick a certain option as opposed to another option.
Mm-hmm.
So that if there is a need at some level to prove that he's a man in his father's eyes, that might move him in a certain direction that another president, say Clinton, for example, who... Since we're into psychobiography.
Completely different psychological profile.
Completely different, but who, in some respects, as I recall, came out of a very difficult relationship with his father and stood up to his father at one point
as a teenager.
And who might not have the same kind of conflicts about what it means to be a son and around masculinity that this president does. So that Clinton might have picked a slightly different option to confront the security threat.
Mm-hmm. So it doesn't mean George W. can't see the threats as they are, possibly, but it does mean that always is there as an influence. We're talking tonight about the dynamics of a father-son war, about two Bushes, Iraq and Saddam Hussein. Is it an errant son's effort to trump his father's legacy, all this talk of war? Or is this all psychobabble, in George W. Bush's phrase? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the dynamics of a potential father-son war, about two Bushes, George H.W., about Iraq and about Saddam Hussein. Could it be that George W. Bush, the son, is trying to one-up his dad in war on Iraq at some psychological level? Or is this misplaced psychological speculation about an all-too-real threat? Is this the price we pay for father-son presidencies, never knowing what's personal and what's geopolitical? Are we on the verge of a father-son war? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Samuel Osherson. He's a practicing psychotherapist on the faculty of the Harvard Medical School and author of Finding Our Fathers, How a Man's Life is Shaped by His Relationship with His Father. And by Bill Minutaglio. He's author of First Son, George W. Bush and the Bush Family Dynasty. And Bill, I want to put it to you, if you can try and picture the message coming down the wire from George Bush Sr. to the sitting president, do you think he's more likely to be saying to his son, get in there and kick some cowtail, son, or slow down, go with the UN, listen to my old buddy Brent Scowcroft. Which message do you imagine is on the line, or is it even that explicit, Bill?
I think, the former. I think his father just is still, and until George W. Bush, I suppose, gets reelected, if he's so fortunate, his father is still the more seasoned hand. His father served at the UN. His father served abroad. His father has traveled. And
so you're saying George Sr. would be saying, go multilateral, wait for the UN blessing, or barge in there?
I think his father is telling him, at the very least, move a little bit more cautiously than you might be prone to do as a personality, as maybe a Texas gunslinger. Please slow down, listen to Scowcroft, talk to the old hands, the old heads who had served in my administration, who are now either serving your administration directly or advising you in some of those backroom meetings. But approach it, learn from the mistakes I made. I think his father also, who is the ultimate political animal, is advising him, keep an eye on the political reality of this. We want you to get reelected. Let's figure out how that plays in and try to remember, why I lost, why I was voted out of the White House.
Well, but you mentioned the enormous influence that Karl Rove has on George W. Bush, and we know that he's been saying, at least in the midterm elections, go with the war theme because it's working for Republicans. We know that Bush the senior was mocked for his wouldn't be prudent kind of line, and prudence is something we don't hear George W. refer to often. Is it possible that if he hears that from his dad, his kind of George W. the son response, whether it's his considered response or not, is, well, your golden boy Jeb may have gone slow and been prudent, but I'm going to prove something else here, Dad.
Yeah, to extend the psychological dimension as we examine him, I believe that George W. is sworn and committed to not making the mistakes that he perceives his father has made, and I think he felt that in some way his father's message about what his father's administration was going to be got lost, that there was almost a mutiny, frankly speaking, at the White House, that toward the tail end of the administration, a lot of people running off in different directions, that they didn't capitalize very well on the testosterone bounce from the Gulf War and somehow or other allowed the economy to become the millstone around their neck, and then they somehow or other, despite all of the great things, the years of experience, the great Bush network and fortune, somehow or other lost an election to a guy from Arkansas. I think George W. Is vowing not to let that happen, and is both listening to his dad. It's the same conundrum, the same dynamic, trying to listen to his dad, profit from his experience, yet at the same time make sure that he doesn't repeat his father's mistakes. And in fact, we'll go all the way with it. Maybe I can trump my dad.
But Jack Beatty, he must be really on a painful hook here. His father, in his own book that he wrote with Brent Scowcroft, said that he was so glad they hadn't gone into Iraq, that the United States could conceivably still be an occupying power in a bitterly hostile land if U.S. troops had gone to Baghdad in the Gulf War. Now, that's exactly the kind of scenario that's being very seriously considered, more than that, being planned and provisioned for.
Yes, it's eerie how history is repeating itself here. And just as with the father, so with the son, his economy is going south just as he's pushing a war. And, of course, we know that one of the consequences of the father's war was a spike in oil prices that pushed the economy over the edge.
But his dad said, I'm glad we didn't go to Baghdad. The son is considering doing just that, even though the same occupation sits there as a possibility, and no one can foretell exactly what the long-term reception of the Iraqi people to occupying U.S. troops would be. So George W. flirting with going in spite of that, in black and white from his dad and Scowcroft, seems like a rebuke to his father.
Well, except that sons often are acting out forbidden wishes from their fathers. And in fact, if George Sr. isn't the competitive person that Bill describes, he may in fact say, I'm glad we didn't go into Baghdad, but there might be a bloodlust in the family that the son at some level is acting out and needs to act out.
Bill Minutaglio, can you imagine that even if Bush the senior advises Bush the president, go easy, go slow, that there's a kind of deeper message, which is, that son of a gun tried to assassinate me in Kuwait City, and you know what that means, son.
Yeah, I think George W., as he sometimes examines himself, if he peers into that mirror and tries to his own growth and tries to see where he's come, I think he's beginning to realize his father is aging before his eyes, and his mom is as well. If you see them, they seem like older folks, and in fact, almost gentler in some way. I think we tend to treat our retired presidents with kid gloves in some way as time goes by, and they are somehow rather redeemed in our eyes. We forget about their politics in some way. But I think George W. is realizing, you know, I'm now the standard bearer. I'm becoming the patriarch, perhaps, in this family. I'm the first son. My parents aren't going to be around all that long. And you hear it. I mean, he still talks very intensely, and he talks about these are the guys who tried to come after my dad, my daddy, my family.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I got hark back. I envision him on Air Force One coming back to Washington, and he picks up the phone, and he's checking on two things, to tap into his father's, you know, wealth of wisdom about international affairs. What the heck just happened, Dad?
On that long day, 9/11 last year.
Yeah, but also, I think, again, germane to this discussion, you know, are you okay, Dad? Where have you been harmed? Are they after you in some way? I think he had to have asked that question. Obviously, a lot of people in security circles would.
Sure.
So it's all interwoven again, and I think we're seeing George W. Bush rushing very quickly to some intense crossroads. I would also, you know, measure in the fact that he's operating in a post 9/11 environment, you know, an attack on our shores that his father never had to contend with.
Simply never had to contend with. I want to get a call in here. Earl's on the line. Hi, Earl. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Real well, thanks.
My thunder's sort of been stolen by the previous two, three callers, but so I quickly want to underscore something that Jack Beatty was alluding to briefly that everyone else emphasized, and then go on to one other dimension. I just want to say that unconscious or not, to play out dark family impulses at the expense of the country and even the planet's destiny is like a once-in-a-millennium outrage. If it's clouding the judgment of Iraq's threat. And
but how can a president who's the son of a president avoid having all of that somehow in play, Earl? Isn't it unavoidable?
I'm not suggesting that it's not going to play a big influence. The issue is that we cannot unravel the puzzle of how much of an influence it is to the point of clouding his perception and judgment about what's really going on in the Gulf. But I wanted to add, may I add an extra dimension about the family matrix or configuration?
All right.
For want of a better term, you know, in the debates against Vice President Gore, we all may remember that President Bush was asked at the time who he sees as a great influence on his life as a political leader, and he said Jesus Christ.
Yes.
And there's a subtext here, and I'm wondering from the biographer whether, especially when there's a greater moment of truth, if our troops are in there and chemical weapons are,
be quick, Earl. Our time is running down. What's your question
the
there?
The question is, what kind of Christian teaching in the Bush family can we look at in terms of examining how far President Bush's leadership will go on a moral level if he's faced
got
with
it, Earl. Let me jump to Bill Minutaglio. What about the issue of religion? Is that
sure.
even something shared between father and son? George
sure,
W. is
sure.
born again. I'm not sure that his father is.
Yeah, let me answer this way, and hopefully it'll add to the entire discussion that started a while ago. I asked Governor Jeb Bush at one point in an interview, what is the most important thing? What's at the core, the marrow? You know, what's the poetry of your brother? What's the ultimate thing about him that makes him tick? And he paused for a while, which I thought was significant because he began chewing it over, probably looking for the correct political answer, and maybe, I think, wanting to give me something that just wasn't the same old answer. He said faith and family. I interpreted that when he said family to really mean, you know, the higher dynamic, not just his wife and children, but the Bush family, that he operates as an outgrowth of growing up in this family, thinking about it, thinking about how to protect it, promote it, and move it forward.
And there it is. You just can't escape it. I guess that's Father,
and then,
Son, and Holy Ghost. Bill Minutaglio, I'm sorry, but we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
Bill Minutaglio is author of First Son, George W. Bush and the Bush Family Dynasty, and also the forthcoming City on Fire. And Samuel Osherson, thank you very much for being in the studio with us.
Pleasure.
Samuel Osherson is author of Finding Our Fathers, How a Man's Life is Shaped by His Relationship with His Father. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us as always.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, the longshoreman lockout starts to have an impact. This is On Point. Shipping companies and dock workers met with a federal mediator today as the labor dispute that has shut down West Coast ports entered its fifth day. Meanwhile, the strike is already affecting businesses in the region. A Fremont, California auto assembly plant shut down today because it ran out of parts. Charlie Wu is the CEO of Megatoys, a toy manufacturer and importer in Los Angeles. In this radio diary, Wu says that his company is also starting to feel the pinch.
Since this is really the crunch time for delivery for the Christmas season for toys, so we have our heaviest shipment coming in around this time of the year. Since last weekend, we have about close to 30 containers stuck on ships outside the harbors. And then we will have another 30 arriving this coming weekend. So they're going to be several hundred thousand toys stuck out there. It takes time to get from the harbor to our warehouse, and we sort out the merchandise and put it in trucks and rails and go across the country and the different distribution center for retail stores, and then they have to deliver to the stores, and it takes several days to sort it out. So it takes several weeks. So because of this delay, we might have difficulty putting the toys on the shelf, but if we cannot deliver on time for the retailer to put it on the shelf, they might want to reduce the order, or they might even want to cancel the order, and we would lose the business. If it settles before the weekend in the next couple of days, you know, I could be able to catch up, you know, with some difficulty, but by and large, I could get most of the merchandise out. But, you know, if 2 weeks' merchandise piling up, it's the problem is bigger. But if it's, you know, 3 weeks' merchandise, it could be such a nightmare that I would probably lose, you know, if not most, half of the Christmas season. Actually, I have talked to manufacturers overseas, and even employees, factory workers overseas. They're more concerned about this than a lot of American citizens, because their jobs depend on the factory producing, and they have a backlog. They don't know when the stuff is going to go out. You know, even the strike is settled, you know, soon, they still don't know when the ship would get back to pick up the load, because as of now, you know, there's no booking for shipment is available, you know, because they just don't know when this is going to be resumed, because the ships won't get back there on time. The complication is quite extensive. I have a manufacturing plant in Los Angeles to do assembly for Valentine and Easter season. Normally, I would start my assembly line by October, November for Valentine, and then December, January for Easter. Now, I don't know when I can start, so there are about a couple hundred people here that in Los Angeles thinking they could get jobs doing this, but now it's they don't know when, you know, we don't know when we can start.
Charlie Wu is CEO of Megatoys, a toy manufacturer and importer in Los Angeles. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Kelly Jones, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Oliver Reed and Sabi Mir. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.